This is Beth Dean for the Washington County Museum interviewing, I pronounce your name correctly,
Vlasta Barber.
At her home on September 27th, 2012. So I'll just set this here and make sure it's getting a good recording. Closer to you. So can you start off by telling a little bit more about your background? It sounds like you grew up in the Portland area.
I was actually born in Maplewood, which is a tiny place near Multnomah, which is near Portland. That was in 1926. Happened to have been on December 7th, which turned out to be Pearl Harbor Day. I went 2 years to Maplewood Grade School, 5 years to Garden Home Grade School. For some reason, they allowed me to skip a grade. So I graduated at the age of 12 and was allowed to write the graduation song for Garden Home Grade School based on the music from La Donna Immobile.
Wow. Do you still remember the song?
Oh, yeah, part of it. Goodbye to Garden Home and to its teachers. And the rest of it I don't remember, which is probably just as well. I went to Tigard High and participated in the orchestra, the operettas, the class play. I was lucky enough to get a scholarship to Reed College for 1 year, and after that we couldn't afford anything else, so I went to work to Agricultural Workers Health Association.
And what year did you start working for that? What is the acronym? AWHA?
AWHA.
What year did you start working with them?
It was in 1944, and I believe that I may have started either in August or September, according to the salary. For those 4 months or 5 months, I received the huge amount of $700.
Wow. Well, for 4 months, yeah, that's not much, is it?
No, it isn't. But I did have it increased. By 1947, I was earning almost $2,800, and that was for a 44-hour week.
Wow.
Because I remember coming home to Garden Home one Saturday, in fact, it was the 4th of July, about 1 o'clock, and very happy to be at home.
Mm-hmm.
So then I was working for AWHA for 3.5 years.
Okay. Now, to take one step backwards, we are doing some research about the Bracero program, which you know. Do you have any personal memories of labor shortage before you started working for AWHA, just in general in the county? Or?
At that age, no. The only thing that I would have known was that many of our friends had been in the military service, and when they came back, they were looking for jobs, or they were going to school under the GI Bill of Rights. Many of them were. In fact, my husband did. So as far as being aware of a labor shortage as such, no, I wasn't.
And that had nothing to do with your employment for?
No. Okay. In fact, I don't even remember how I learned about the job. But our family had always subscribed to at least 2 newspapers, 2 in English, 2 in Czech language. And AWHA had probably posted some sort of a help wanted notice in the Oregon Journal or the News Telegram.
So for you, it was essentially just a job.
That's correct.
I'm wondering for a woman in that time period, was that typical to go out and find it?
I don't know about that. My mother, who was born in what is now the Czech Republic, at the age of 17, by that time she had had 2 years of college, was manager of an artist group. So following her, I wouldn't have had any problems.
Yeah.
And my older sister started working when she was about 19. So as far as our family went, the women were in the workplace just like anybody else. And incidentally, my father, who was born in what is now the Czech Republic, always said, yes, I am the head of the family, but mama or mother is the neck that turns the head.
I've heard that before. That's a good description, I think.
Yes.
So, I'm sorry.
Go ahead and what?
No, I was just going to follow along with the AWHA. So it sounds like you probably saw an advertisement and needed a job.
Certainly needed a job. Our family was possibly what might be called now in the poverty area, but we didn't know it at that time.
Hmm.
We lived out in the country. My dad worked 6 days a week in his own tailor shop, but on Sundays and after work in the summertime, he raised a big garden. So we really didn't suffer as far as food went. And clothing that was made by my mother, who, interestingly enough, spoke four languages, did translating, was a wonderful baker, sewer, cheated everything.
Superhuman.
So then you're interested in what AWHA
did? And if you can explain what AWHA was, even, and what your what your particular job was.
The Agricultural Workers Health Association furnished the medical equipment and supplies for the migrant workers from Mexico, the Bahamas, and Bermuda. And it's interesting, at least to me, that I didn't even hear the word bracero in regard to that until a few years ago. It was just not used. We talked about the migrant workers, but not braceros. AWHA had mostly women in its employ, I suppose mainly because the fellows were just now coming back or going to college. So there were, I'd say, about eight or nine of us that worked directly for AWHA. It itself was part of the Production and Marketing Administration, which was part of the Department of Agriculture. Because it was a temporary federal agency, it was a quasi-federal agency where neither FICA nor civil service retirement was taken out of your pay. This meant that if you went on to work for civil service, which I did, those 3.5 years didn't count as part of your federal service. If you went into private practice, you know, public, if you went to work for a non-governmental agency, those 3.5 years didn't work or didn't count for Social Security because you hadn't had FICA taken out.
Hmm.
So it would have affected both civil service annuities or any pensions that your employer might have had for you or Social Security. The office itself was in the terminal sales building. I don't remember exactly what the address was, but it was in downtown Portland. The warehouse with the supplies where I went to work was probably across the street from the terminal sales building, and the ground floor was where the papers, the documents, the orders came in. The supplies themselves were in an interesting basement area that was accessed by climbing down a ladder. You had to open the trap door and then go down the ladder, pick up your supplies, bring them up, package them, and get them ready for shipping. When I think back on it, I sort of wonder that I didn't fall off the ladder or something. But anyway, it was very interesting work. The lady whose position I took was going back to college or something, I don't remember what. She was a black lady, so I can say that my very first immediate supervisor was an African American. She was very nice, and I learned where the different things were. I honestly don't remember how long I did that job, but I don't think it was very long. And then I was invited and promoted to the office area. And I think for a while I was doing the ordering of the medical supplies, because I remember one item was 5,005 grain aspirins that came from a drugstore, and they cost $5. 5,000 for $5. Huh. My memory going back to, 60, 65 years is not that great, but I think that I must have been promoted to perhaps a grade 5. And at that time, I was told that I could travel to the various clinics if I wanted to do that in order to set up the inventory records for them. So I did travel by plane to Yakima, Washington, Caldwell, and Twin Falls, Idaho, Boulder, Colorado, and somewhere near Salt Lake City, Utah. And I have no memory of where the clinic was in Utah. The clinic in Yakima had a doctor, a nurse, and a dentist. Whether they were there full-time, I don't know. Possibly they were, because the number of the migrant workers was quite large. They worked in the apple orchards, and what other crops they may have harvested, I don't know. In Caldwell, they worked in the potato fields, and some of them belonged to a millionaire, possibly a billionaire, whose last name was Simplot, S-I-M-P-L-O-T. And his name is still in existence in Idaho. Not he, but possibly his heirs. I don't remember anything about the clinic in Twin Falls. I do remember that I went to a movie and saw Henry Fonda in My Darling Clementine. and then took a train from Twin Falls back to Boise. And on that train, I met a jewelry salesman. And we talked, and it was interesting. I think that usually the planes that I took were Northwest, not the Northwest that was in existence until just a few months or years ago. Much smaller planes. In fact, they were the Electra jets, whatever that is.
Yeah.
So,
Now, when you were at the clinics, do you remember seeing the migrant workers, or you were just working behind the scenes doing inventory?
It was seldom that I saw any of the workers at all. Usually just in the office part of it, yeah. Mm-hmm. In Caldwell, most of the employees were Japanese because they were the ones who had been moved off their land by President Roosevelt's executive order and probably had been moved to someplace like Ontario, which is very close to Caldwell. They were very interesting to talk to. One of them said that in order to get that job there, she had to be much, much better in every aspect of her work than anybody else because she was Japanese. I think that that was the only place where I encountered anybody who was not a Caucasian at the clinics. I may have forgotten, but I don't think so.
Were you part of, or did you overhear discussions about the workers, or?
No.
No, that was...
No, I had nothing to do with that. Mm-hmm. I set up the medical inventory records for them, and that was about it. I may have helped them do an inventory, probably did, but I can't say for sure. The inventories were interesting. Besides the normal medications that you would expect to find, like Pepto-Bismol and aspirin, they also ordered and carried things like Mefarsin, which was something that was given to the workers if they contracted syphilis or gonorrhea. That actually was something that was taken care of by Dr. Lauren Kerr, who was not employed by AWHA. You might want to turn the... I don't know what he...
Oh, he left a brochure, I think.
Oh, okay.
Dr. Kerr?
Mm-hmm. K-E-R-R, Lauren, L-O-R-E-N. He actually worked as civil service, as did his secretary, whose name was Juanita Sutterfield. The inventory also included small tools like Kelly forceps, bandage scissors, ear speculi, and even a sphygmomanometer.
What is that? Never heard that word before.
It's not used anymore.
Okay.
It's a blood pressure instrument.
Oh.
But I always thought that was such an interesting word. So many syllables. Let's see.
I'm curious about the medical, well, like you're saying, the medications or what they had present, because we were hearing that, you know, falling off trucks or what the injuries that are associated with that type of migrant work. I'm just curious if that...
I never heard of any of the migrant workers falling off a truck and breaking a leg or anything like that. That doesn't mean that it didn't happen.
Mm-hmm.
It's that I didn't know of that myself.
Yeah.
I seem to recall that the workers were seasonal, of course, and would come at the time that they were needed, either in the potato fields or the apple orchards. Oh, yes, and in Utah and also in Colorado and Idaho, they picked or they harvested sugar beets.
That seems like one of the more common crops that we're hearing about.
Yes.
Sugar beets are okay.
You didn't, as far as I know, you didn't need any special experience in order to work in that kind of area.
Hmm. You are one of the few people that have mentioned the men from Barbados and from, you mentioned another.
Bermuda.
Bermuda. That, do you know anything else about that, or you just know that they were...
Nothing.
Yeah.
Absolutely nothing.
Because we're not seeing those people, those Bermudans or Barbadians showing up in Washington County, but certainly maybe in eastern Oregon, or like you were saying, in Washington.
Since I didn't really meet very many of the migrant workers, I cannot say where they worked. So that...
No, but it's fast. And so then the organization you said, AWHA, was temporary, right? A temporary administration.
Mm-hmm.
Do you and so I assume it was created for the influx of workers.
Mm-hmm. That was all it was for.
That was all
yes.
it was for. So do you remember when it disbanded, or had you moved on
yes.
at that point? Okay.
January of 1948.
So that exact... That's interesting.
Mm-hmm.
And were you working up with them until that point?
Mm-hmm. And during that month, the equipment from the office was auctioned off, not only a regular auction, but the people who had worked there could buy any of the things that they wanted. Well, there wasn't very much that I wanted, but I did buy... one pair of Kelly forceps just to have a souvenir. And I'm sure I must have paid at least 50 cents for it. So
that's your souvenir from...
That, and I still have it.
Huh. Interesting. What other memories do you have of AWHA, just in general? Either work memories or maybe trips?
Oh, well, as far as the trips, there was one... airplane flight coming back from Boise to Portland, where we ran through quite a storm. I thought I was pretty grown up at 20 or 21, and I had ordered a cup of coffee, and right at that time I was holding the cup in my hand, and something made the plane drop immediately, and of course my hand did just the opposite. It raised the cup practically over my head. I was very fortunate. None of the coffee spilled on me.
How is that possible? Did it spill on the person?
It went straight up.
Huh.
That was very interesting. And one time in Yakima, the doctor and the nurse, who were both fairly young and very nice looking and very kind people, fixed me up with a blind date with a young man who was about 6'4". We went out to dinner, and the four of us then went to a dance. And if you are 5'2" and you're trying to dance with a 6'4", it is not very comfortable. But I enjoyed it, and I hope that he didn't mind. I have some pictures, very old pictures, black and white, of course, that were taken in Caldwell, because there are, well, there's at least one Japanese lady in it. Why I didn't take any pictures in Yakima, I don't know. I may not have had a camera at that time. So I just had pictures of Caldwell. Oh, and in Boulder, Colorado, was the first time that I had ever tasted bison, or what most Americans refer to as buffalo. And it was sort of like beef and not too bad.
That's about it was all served to you at a restaurant or at some
Oh, at a restaurant. Oh, yes. Huh. Oh, yeah. And in Yakima, the three of us, the doctor, the nurse, and I, would sometimes have lunch at what might now be called a fast food place, where I always had a grilled cheese sandwich for lunch. And I think that the flies that were in there enjoyed it just about as much as I did. That was a terrible place to eat. And the I remember that one time I was in Yakima, probably in early December, and the dentist had bought some presents for his family and was having a terrible time thinking of how he was going to wrap them for Christmas. So I offered to help him. So the two of us were in my hotel room with the door wide open and sitting in the chairs and wrapping gifts for him to give away. So it was, those were interesting trips that I took. Oh, yes. In Yakima, I stayed in the Commercial Hotel, which was still in existence, I'd say about 7 or 8 years ago when we went by it just to see what it looked like. And I paid $4 a night there. And I seem to recall that the per diem at that time was $5 a day, which meant that I could spend as much as I wanted for food or anything else and would be reimbursed $5. And the rest of it was out of my pocketbook.
I see. Now, during the war, I wonder if you have other memories of like what your family was experiencing. You were traveling and working for AWHA. What was the atmosphere for other people?
For our family, it was not good because all of my parents' relatives were in what was then Czechoslovakia. Mm. And until May of 1945, they were living under the Nazi rule, which was terrible. My mother tried to communicate with her brother and sisters, and one time she sent a letter that had the stamp on it that had part of the Champions of Liberty on it that came out in 45, I think it was, and it had the portrait of Thomas Masaryk on it. Now, he was the first president of Czechoslovakia. That letter came back with a notation on it: "We don't need this kind of information here," from the post office that, of course, was run by the Nazis. It was difficult for my parents because they didn't know what was happening to their relatives. fortunately, they came out alive. And in 1958, my mother made her first trip back to her homeland in since 1920, when she had come here. So times were not easy mentally for them. We were probably, I don't know, possibly better off than some people because we raised our own food. 1 year, my mother put up 300 quarts of tomato juice.
300?
Probably 100 quarts of plums, because we had a plum tree, we had two pie cherry trees, and we were pretty self-sufficient, except that when my dad would come home on Saturday afternoon, maybe around 6 o'clock, he would bring home a quart of either ice cream or sherbet, which had been packed in dry ice, because, of course, he was taking the bus home. We didn't have a car at that time. We went everywhere on the bus. And during those years, we also were very involved in the International Red Cross and had lots of programs, various places, like the Norse Hall, and raised money to send to the countries that were overrun by the Nazis. And in fact, in 1947, we had gathered enough food, fabric, things like threads and needles, and sent 200 packages to an orphanage in Czechoslovakia. Mm-hmm. And my family was involved in programs for the people who were being inaugurated as new U.S. citizens. So we were very involved in a lot of things. How we could do it with the small amount of money that was coming in, I don't know.
Yeah.
But we did.
Yeah, it seems like it's sort of one is lesser of two evils in a sense. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
That's all perspective.
And having been born on the day that later would become Pearl Harbor Day was interesting.
That is.
Because that morning, Sunday morning, I had been promised by Mama that we would go downtown and see a movie. I was wearing my very best hand-me-down dress, and I still remember what it was, black and white check with a red sash. And when we heard the news, then, of course, we didn't go downtown, so I didn't get to see a movie on my birthday, and that was my 15th birthday.
Did you understand the magnitude of... Well, I suppose no one really understood what was...
No, I don't think so. We just knew that something was happening on the other side of the world that would be as bad as what had been happening for a couple of years in Europe. Mm. Yeah, my folks would have. I don't know whether I did or not. Mm. But I knew that something had to be done for the people that were... in such bad situation. And at that time, I was going to Tigard High, and there was at least one Japanese fellow there. And his family had a strawberry farm. And they were moved. And I don't know whether they were sent to a concentration camp near Klamath Falls, or whether they went to Ontario. And then later, when I was working for IRS in LA, I worked with a fellow whose family had been in a concentration camp in California. So those were not good days. And then 40 years of communism for our relatives
right.
was not good either.
Right. Now, one of the, just a follow-up question with the bracero. You mentioned that you had never heard the word bracero until a few years ago. When did you hear it, I guess, or how did that word come to you?
I don't remember, except that it was indelibly inked into my brain when the Oregon Historical Society had their exhibit mm-hmm. with regard to the braceros. But the word itself, of course, is Spanish or Mexican, and I probably heard it when a large number of migrant workers started coming, say, to Hillsboro, and there were large numbers of them, too, that came into the Los Angeles area, not into the city itself, but out in the rural areas. And at that time, we were auditing a large number of Mexicans who hadn't paid their income tax returns, and they would be brought in by immigration, and we would do the auditing right there. Those are interesting times too.
Now, so then you said you continued working for the government, but in a different capacity.
I worked 2 years for a private concern from 48 to 50 to February 15th of 1950. It was called National Tank and Pipe Company. I was working as the secretary to the construction engineer. And when I decided to move on to other things and apply for a civil service position, one of my younger twin sisters took over my job and was there for 51 years.
Wow. So you paved the way for her, obviously.
Well, yes. But in May of 1950, I started working for what was then known as the Collector of Internal Revenue. And then later it was called Internal Revenue something, and then finally it became Internal Revenue Service.
Hmm.
And I worked for them for 30 years.
IRS, okay. Huh. So you've had a string of very interesting jobs.
Yes, they were.
Yeah. How did you feel about your work in general for AWHA?
Well, number one, I was very pleased to have been given the position, the job. And then I was extremely happy to be allowed to travel around
mm-hmm.
and to be given a job that, when I think about it, they were probably taking a chance on somebody that was my age, 19, 20, 21, but I guess they were pleased because I was able to keep the job until the agency was dissolved.
Mm-hmm.
And I got to meet a lot of nice people. In fact, I can't remember any that I didn't particularly like. So I was appreciative of AWHA.
Mm-hmm. Great. Those are sort of my main questions. We're just trying to figure out the link, AWHA, anything, sort of this labor shortage, but that goes hand in hand. That shows us information about the men being away at war. And
you know, I was talking to a friend a couple of days ago, and when I mentioned this upcoming interview, she said, "Oh, I'm going to go on the internet and see what I can find."
Hmm.
So what she found was that there is a man by the name of Gamboa
Yes.
who wrote a book.
Yes.
And she wanted me to mention that to you, which I didn't need to do since you already know
No,
about
but
it.
we appreciate it. He came when Oregon Historical Society had the Smithsonian's traveling exhibit on the Bracero. He came down from Washington, well, University of Washington, and he spoke. So we had the chance to meet him, and he's sort of the person that's writing the most information about Braceros. But we're learning, okay, so we're having trouble finding specific Bracero information, so we're widening the scope to, your experiences and what was the labor shortage like? What were people in this area doing, during that time period? So if you have any other suggestions of people to speak with,
You know,
too.
the strange thing is, until the lady that called me
Eileen O'Malley.
Eileen, until she had mentioned various clinics in Oregon, I wasn't aware of where those clinics were because I never was sent to any of them. So I don't know how many workers may have been in the state of Oregon, nor where they worked, nor what kind of crops they harvested.
So that must have been another AWHA employee that was working at
There
clinics
wasn't anybody else that I knew of that
that was
was
doing
sent
that
out,
job.
no. And I knew everybody that worked for AWHA.
Wonder if the clinics were placed in places with larger labor forces, because certainly Eastern Washington would have had more, like the Yakima Valley with the orchards. I'm sure they would have had more braceros.
You mean domestic workers?
Well, or migrant
Oh,
laborers, I
yes,
would think.
that's true. Well, that's something I hadn't thought of before, but that's probably true. Maybe the areas that had truck farms didn't really need a large number of
That's
migrant
true.
workers, and perhaps they had enough domestic help laborers, so the migrant workers were only brought to those areas where they really needed hundreds of them. Excuse me, that's just a
It's a thought.
speculation on my part.
But it seems somewhat logical.
Oh, and my friend also mentioned that there is a gentleman who is running for representative, state representative, by the name of Gallegos.
Oh, I haven't. Yes, I or there's another Castaneda, I think. Castaneda.
She didn't mention that name, so
Gallegos.
I don't know. They live in Hillsboro, so it would be whatever district that is.
Okay, I'll look that up, see if he has.
And what was interesting to me was that Eileen said she had gone into the internet to look me up and that she found that I was quite involved in Czech things. And I said, that's interesting. I've never gone into the internet to find out
For
about me because I
yourself.
think I know me.
You better Google yourself and see what's up. So what do you do? I mean, this is aside from the topic group, but what do you do for the Czech community?
Right now, I'm the historian, the newsletter editor. I prepare the address labels. I'm usually in charge of all the sales of the donated items. For several years, I was the president. Before that, for several years, I was the vice president. Before that, I was the secretary for 6 years. And before that, we weren't in Portland.
Is there a center, or does it is it just sort of a
Oh
meet
no, we have a very
informal?
small group. At the moment, we have about 87
That's
members,
good.
and we meet four times a year for just regular membership meetings. We have one annual picnic and one Christmas dinner where in the past we've had traditional Czech food served.
Mm.
And we always had St. Nicholas, the angel, and the devil come and entertain the children and the adults.
Huh. Hmm. And you grew up in a bilingual family, or your mother spoke four languages?
Yes.
So you
actually
speak Czech.
Czech was my first language.
Okay. Wow. I can't imagine that very many young people are learning Czech these days.
No, they're not. Their parents apparently have a different idea than my folks did. Both of them felt that the more languages you knew, the better off you were. Now I know many families say, well, we came to America, we're going to speak English, and we're not going to worry about the Czech language.
Mm-hmm.
Some of them don't even want to go back to visit their homeland, which I think is pretty stupid.
Sad. Yeah.
But my husband and I went there 9 times. Let's see. 3 times under communism, and then the other times they were already a democratic republic.
Hmm. I'm curious. I mean, I think I told you I'm a fourth Czech, but I don't know that much about our background, except that my great uncle did some family genealogical work, and so
mm-hmm.
he spent some time in the Czech Republic. But
it's a beautiful country.
Yeah.
And looks much like Western Oregon, and I'm sure that's why my father settled here. For several years, he was in Chicago and learned the tailor business. And then when his boss moved out here, his boss was so pleased with my dad's work ethic that he paid his way from Chicago out here. And Daddy liked it so well that he just stayed. So,
So that's how you... Yeah. Well, it's there must be a large population in Iowa, if that's why Cedar Rapids
there,
has
the
center.
Iowa, quite a number in Wisconsin, Kansas, many, many in Texas.
Texas.
And those are mainly the people that came in through Galveston.
Mm.
But Ennis has had an annual polka festival. Temple, Texas has a huge museum that has many of the national, I don't want to say costume because they're not really costumes, national dress.
Mm.
And in Dallas itself, at one time, they had a chapter of the Sokol and a chapter of a Catholic group and a chapter of another, I think it was an insurance group. So while we were living in the Dallas area, we went to all three different groups and were involved in the polka festival and then the parades and in the state fair that was held in Dallas, where I had an authentic costume, and one of the days was Czechoslovak Day, because at that time they were still one country. And my husband went along with all of that. He was what you might call a true American. He had English, Scottish, Irish, and American Indian roots.
So he was.
In fact, he was enrolled with the Muscogee Creek Nation in Oklahoma.
Huh.
He was born in Oklahoma.
Okay. So yeah, so you came from a very specific cultural background, and he had all of that.
Yep.
Fascinating. It sounds like you're still a very busy woman, so.
Well, I'm also the, well, they call it care and concern for the retired federal employees. And I do the newsletter for our high school class. And I used to do lots and lots of translating of genealogy for, I'd say, for about 20 different people. Which is interesting to me because I have done no genealogy as such for our family.
Oh,
I
interesting.
just haven't had the time.
Yeah.
And I know a little bit about our family on both sides going back two generations, which is not very much. All interesting people.
Yeah.
Architects, builders, a beekeeper.
That's interesting. Was that on the Bohemian side or
Yes,
okay?
seamstress. On daddy's side, there was a man who played first violin in the Chicago Symphony. He was daddy's brother-in-law because he had married daddy's sister. Daddy's younger brother was quite, I don't know exactly how to put it, but he was quite a ladies' man and was very good friends with a physician who lived in Czechoslovakia. Daddy hardly ever talked about himself unless you pressed him, did you do this or what did you do then? But he was someone who was interested in, he was a patriot. And when he applied to join the U.S. forces in 1917, they told him he was too old, he was 35, so he joined the Czech forces of the French Foreign Legion.
Wow. Wow.
And was there through the end of the war and then was part of the occupation forces to make sure that all the Hungarian and Austrian forces moved out of the new Republic of Czechoslovakia. And one time, evidently, they were a group of his soldiers were running after some Hungarians and they were shouting, "Hurrah, hurrah!" It doesn't mean hooray. It means get out of here or something like that. But they were running after them with their rifles, which had no ammunition that fit those rifles. So if the Hungarians had turned around and shot at them, they wouldn't have been able to shoot back. So,
Scary.
yeah. I didn't learn that until, gosh, it must have been 40 years ago.